lawmakers and policymakers won't come out with harebrained proposals to reform our way our immigration laws are implemented, and that this time law enforcement agencies like the FBI and the NYPD won't descend on entire communities rather than, you know, conduct their work in a more targeted fashion. But again, I'm sure that my hope is going to be dashed time and again. Every time something like this happens, be it in New York or overseas or elsewhere in the United States, there's no shortage of people, dozens of people who will come into our offices at CLEAR saying, for example, that they're being approached for questioning by the FBI, even though they have no connection to what happened.
Thank Ramzi Kassem, CUNY law professor, Nazia Kazi, who is at Stockton University. Debbie Almontasser, thanks so much for joining us. And I want to thank our guest in Philadelphia, Haji Youssef. Thanks so much.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Palestinian Childhood Under Occupation, a talk on Monday, September 19th at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Church in Portland. Jennifer Bang, Brad Parker, and other speakers will talk about the issues faced by Palestinian children living under Israeli occupation, including children in detention, issues in health and mental health, the state of education, and more. Again, that's Palestinian Childhood Under Occupation, a talk on Monday, September 19th at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Step House Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet services throughout the Portland area. More information about Step House internet services is available at 503-548-2000 or at stephouse.net. Up next is your Tuesday evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on our hour-long membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, the Social Justice Action Center is facing foreclosure, but grassroots activists are waging a capital campaign to keep it open. We speak with them live in Studio 2.
The biggest methanol refinery in the world is being proposed for Coloma, Washington.
And here is the latest report on the Nestle Corporation's water scheme for Hood River and Cascade Locks.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 20th, 2016. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by calling 877-500-5266. I'm Tony.
I'm Kanan Schlesinger. The Social Justice Action Center is casting a wide net for support as it faces the loss of its office space. Joining us to talk about why the center is a crucial space to keeping available for grassroots organizing is Marco Mejia and Brush. Thanks for coming in, both of you.
You're welcome. It's good to be here.
So let's get started by talking about all the things that Social Justice Action Center does for local activist groups. Yeah, and I'll direct that at you, Marco. Sorry.
Okay. Well, I'd like to, for studying this, to read the purpose, because that will help us a lot to learn better what center.
Sorry, can you start that again? I don't think your mic is
course.
Live.
Yeah. So I was saying that it is important for me to start reading, and I'm gonna read the purpose of the Social Justice Action Center. That will help us to understand from the beginning, you know, what it is. And the Social Justice Action Center is run by and for grassroots organizations, especially those of people of color and marginalized communities, as a place to gather, organize, and build culture. Through this work, these groups will also build relationships with each other and gain experience working across differences towards mutual understanding and solidarity.
Hmm. So some of our listeners might know of the Social Justice Action Center, but what's the story behind it? How did it come together, Marco? Or well, either of you.
Yeah, well, yeah, I can start and then Brash can continue. I think that it is always a need, I think, for groups and organizations, especially those that don't have much funding, whether they're grassroots organizations or very low-income nonprofit organizations, etc., that don't have a space to meet, a space to organize their events, etc., etc. So I think that that's one of the realities that we've been facing. And then there's this opportunity that comes up that there's this space that actually Brash can help us to have a little bit of history and how the place came up and as an opportunity actually to buy it and to have it, you know, as a project that could be helping those groups and organizations to supply the space, which is not just for a space, you know, a physical space, which is very important to have it, but a space that has its own life and its own purpose. And maybe Brash can help us with a little bit of the history.
Sure, yeah. You know, we started in the early summer of 2015 last year, and at that point, you know, just we're revamping the space, rebuilding it out, and then starting to get organizations and groups to know about it and to start using it. And for a year, we've been doing that and building kind of a model for the finances of the space in which it's supported by kind of renting out the kitchen, and that allows us to have the core meaning and purpose of the organization be able to happen on a sliding scale, so groups are able to use it regardless of their income. And so we've been building that for the last year, and also building the organizational structure to be, you know, led by and rooted in the grassroots and especially people of color organizations that are the core constituency. And that's what's come together over the last year and a half.
So which groups that our listeners might recognize regularly meet at the spaces, and how has it continued playing a critical role in holding space for organizers and activists?
I think it's been especially word of mouth, you know, that people don't have the space for meeting, etc. But many of the groups that have been participating, just for people to have an idea, are Portland 10s United, Strike Debt, Native Narcotics Anonymous, September 9th, Prisoner Solidarity, Colombia Solidarity Group, African Hip Hop Caravan, Report Back, Portland Underground Graduate Schools, La Cora Solidarity Project, and I can go on and on and on. So just to give you an idea, that's a lot of the different groups that actually don't have a space, and that this actually is the opportunity for them to gather. And it's been open permanently, you know, every day. And there's a scheduling that, you know, they come in and they look for the timing that they need, and then they are just located into the schedule, and they use it.
And what's the story behind why the space is at jeopardy right now?
Totally. Yeah. So, you know, as I said, we've been able to build a business model, like a constant structure, which brings in the monthly needed money. But we've been able to do it in a way that the seller, who's a friendly person, is willing to sell it to us below market rate for basically taking over their outstanding debts on the mortgage. But there is a big upcoming payment, a one-time payment that's really needed for that. If we can get that $20,000 that we're aiming for, and we're well on our way by the October 5th is our goal, then we'll be able to not only pay that one payment, but be actually stepping into a long-term financing structure that will kind of solidify it for generations. And so we're really excited about that. It's a bit of a scary moment because, you know, it's uncertain, but we're really excited. And in particular, we just learned just a couple of days ago that because of the outreach, because of the people that are really excited about this, an incredibly generous community member has stepped forward to match donations one-to-one up to the total of our goal. And so we're now in a position where every one of the donations that anybody makes is doubled. You know, $10 becomes 20, 100 becomes 200. So that's something we're really excited about right now and wanting to just let everyone know.
So Marco, you've spent many years organizing communities in Oregon. What are some of the important resources that grassroots organizers need that are approved by the center? And Brash, feel free to chime in on that one too.
Well, I think that there is not any rules if you want it. I think that the basic idea of the center is to offer, you know, to groups and community organizations and grassroots, especially groups that need the space for a number of different uses that they can have. So as I mentioned, you know, some of the groups are even, you know, groups that are doing human personal support, you know, in empowerment, you know, personal and spiritual. Some other groups are doing cultural activity and developing, you know, the their space, you know, from their perspective of the culture and expression and that kind of thing. There's other groups that are doing, you know, education and trainings because that's what they need for leadership development or any other kind of training that they need. So this is I think that the main thing for this space is that is required is that the group and organization, you know, it's actually doing and being loyal, if you want it, you know, to community organizations and the purpose, you know, to advance and to look for a new, you know, society and world, you know, that is possible. You know, I just remember now the another world that's possible, right? And it's that kind of perspective and idea. So it's pretty open. And of course, you know, I think that one of the basic things that we have is that this is a space where we promote nonviolent action, but we promote a lot of peaceful, very active, you know, activism and work. So that's what I can say. I like to say that when we are talking about this space, is especially like for me, it's like a community garden. Right, when people come from different walks of life, but their main thing is, you know, to grow food, so we can you know, feed ourselves and grow and be healthy. So this space is like that for me. And the special thing is for a community garden is that if nobody takes care of it, there won't be any food, there won't be any harvest, right? And everything will be dead. So this community garden is our community. And with our organizations and groups and people that are in need of this space, you know, to grow this kind of resource, some sort of food that we have, you know, that everyone is already producing. So if anyone out there, you know, wants to help to have, you know, this community garden called the Social Justice Action Center, you know, we have to help a little bit to chip in with any things that they can, you know. At this moment, we need that funding. That is very important, you know. And as many people know, you know, we need some funding to have the space, especially if we have a special, a physical space, cost a lot of money. But at the same time, you know, we have other needs that people can come, you know, and help with volunteering, because there's a lot of people that say, well, I don't have money. You know, that's especially, you know, a lot of the community members that we have there's opportunities to be volunteering, to be participating in different ways.
Mm-hmm. So we're running a little bit short on time, but I really want to address two things. One is, can you briefly talk about what happens if we start losing these spaces?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've been seeing it already, right? All over town, community organizations are being kicked out, and low-income housing. There's also low-income housing in the building in the upstairs. This is an example of how we can stop that from happening, how we can establish long-term places. And I just want to say, we have an event coming up on October 4th. It's our kind of our finale. Please come. There'll be a silent auction. We'll be having music and conversation about exactly this, about how different kinds of organizations are getting kicked out, but how we can take them back and hold these spaces for the long term. And you know, the Social Justice Action Center is also using this space to build relationships between community organizations. We're hiring a community organizer with a grant as soon as we're done with this. And so everyone out there, we need your help right now, and it's going to pay back over and over.
Great. Well, we have to leave it there. Before we go, though, can you tell us where listeners can go to contribute?
So our website is sjacpdx.org, sjacpdx.org. And you can go to the contribute page there. We also have a crowdfunding site at ucaring.org/sjac.
Thank you so much, Brush. Marco, really appreciate you taking the time to come out. That was Marco Mejia and Brush speaking on the new capital campaign by Social Justice Action Center, which is now in jeopardy of losing its funding. Find out more about them at sjacpdx.org.
And we'll be back to the volunteer-produced KBOO Evening News in just a moment. But right now, this is your time to give us a call. Go online at kboo.fm and contribute to the KBOO fall fundraising efforts that are going on right now and support shows and programming like this amazing daily 1 hour long community focused evening news show that you just heard. Here we go. We have a Social Justice Action Center, a community organization underfunded, in dire need of help. Where do they go? They go to KBOO. They say, this is a place that I can go where we know our voices can be heard on the air. We can put it out. We can have that discussion archived where people can search it on the website. This is an amazing resource. So give us a call, 877-500-5266. We'd love to have you become a member. Increase your membership to KBOO by making a monthly deduction. Easy, simple, secure. What do you think, Conch?
877-500-KBOO. Like Emery said, and Emery is a participant, one of the editors for the news. We have different ones 5 days a week. And this is true. There's a lot of people who complain about affordable housing and affordable venues for art and music that go missing every year in this town. But KBOO tells you how you can help overcome that, how you can help preserve that with stories like this one. So this is something you can support. We help keep your town affordable, lively, and interesting. So you can support us by calling toll-free 877-500-KBOO. That's 877-500-5266. And now, more important news.
An enormous methanol refinery is being proposed on the Columbia River at Kalama, Washington. Protesters gathered last Wednesday in a show of defiance against Northwest Innovation Works, a corporation funded by the Chinese government that's proposing the methanol terminal. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has the story.
I spoke with Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey, senior organizer of Columbia Riverkeeper, about Wednesday's rally against the world's largest methanol facility in Kalama, Washington.
We are a nonprofit clean water advocacy organization working throughout the Columbia to protect the river and the people connected to it. Some of the biggest threats that we've seen recently to the Columbia River and the communities alongside it are these fossil fuel export terminals that are being proposed. It started with coal export, and now we're seeing oil terminals and the methanol refinery and export terminal in Kalama, Washington, which is about 30 miles north of Portland off of I-5.
Jasmine, Northwest Innovation Works actually proposed three massive gas-to-methanol refineries, one in Tacoma, Washington, one in Kalama, Washington, and one in Port Westward near St. Helens, Oregon. Why would the company need three such massive sites?
Yes. So when Northwest Innovation Works first came into the community, they're a company that's backed by the Chinese government, and they came and proposed not one, but three methanol refineries, two in the state of Washington and one in Oregon near Clatskanie, Port Westward. Now, the one in Tacoma really raised the attention of the community and community members, port commissioners, and members of the Tacoma Public Utilities Council ended up asking some really serious questions about the safety, the water use, the electricity use of building a methanol refinery in Tacoma. And rather than answering those questions, Northwest Innovation Works just packed up and left. And since then, we've seen them double down on their efforts here in Kalama to push this project through, essentially before people have time to start asking those really important questions that they refused to answer in Tacoma.
One of the questions that comes to my mind, Jasmine, is that when I think back to discussions with Columbia Riverkeepers around the Vancouver oil terminal, there was a lot of public inquiry up front before any permits were issued and so on. Yet this massive gas to methanol refinery in Kalama, Washington seems to be approved, or seems to be able to be approved, if you will, by just the port of Kalama and the county of Cowlitz. How can that be?
Yeah. So So Northwest Innovation Works has kept a very low profile in Kalama in terms of letting the public know about the project. Kalama, for reference, is a town of about 2,300 people, and this project has been, you know, considered for a few years now, and people still don't know about it. When I talk to folks, they still actually don't know what's happening or who that company is or what methanol is. So the company itself and the port have done a terrible job of alerting a very small town where getting the word out is actually quite easy. They've tried to just play it under the radar. And Northwest Innovation Works has completed their draft environmental impact statement and is awaiting that final environmental impact statement, which is expected to come out sometime late 2016 or early 2017. I'll compare that with what's happening in Vancouver with the proposed oil terminal. That proposed oil terminal is getting a broad environmental review that's being conducted by a statewide panel of experts. It's called the Energy Facility Siting Evaluation Council, and then they make a recommendation to the governor, and the governor will then decide if the Vancouver oil terminal is to be built. Here in Kalama, the agencies that are overseeing the environmental review are the Port of Kalama and Cowlitz County. And that's it. And the Port of Kalama is obviously already collecting, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in rent from Northwest Innovation Works, and the county is anticipating, you know, their tax, you know, revenue increasing greatly. So we're seeing a very, very minor, small, highly biased environmental review for this project here in Kalama as opposed to the other export terminals that we've seen on the Columbia. It is quite shocking that if it were built, it would be the largest methanol refinery in the world. If you appreciate, you know, efforts to curb climate change, then your opinion is more than welcome at the Port of Kalama. We need people to give 2 minutes of public testimony, encouraging the commission to back out of their lease with Northwest Innovation Works, and the Port of Kalama meets, you know, twice a month. Their information's online, and the local community-led website where folks can get involved is called cleanairkalama.com, and that's the same with the Facebook page, Clean Air Kalama.
Jasmine, thank you very much for your time. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
The chairman of the Standing Rock Tribe has officially asked the United Nations to help oppose construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. David Archambault II specifically invoked sovereign tribal rights of the Lakota Sioux Nation in detail in his address to the world governing body in Switzerland today. Archambault said in part, quote, "This company has knowingly destroyed sacred sites and our ancestral graves with bulldozers. This company has also used guard dogs to harm individuals who tried to protect our water and sacred sites. While we have gone to the court in the United States, our courts have failed to protect our sovereign rights, our sacred places, and our water," end quote. The United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues rebuked the U.S. government on September 2nd for not ensuring that the Dakota Access LLC had followed the law in mapping out the pipeline. Critics say the Dakota pipeline could pollute the water supply for future generations.
The Center for Biological Diversity has released a new analysis of federal data concerning the Dakota Access Pipeline. According to the report, the conglomerate behind the pipeline, Energy Transfer Partners, has spilled 9,500 barrels of oil over the past 10 years, resulting in $9.5 million in property damage. 3 years ago, documents released by the North Dakota state government showed 154 rulings in favor of ExxonMobil by North Dakota Governor Jack Dalrymple. Dalrymple, known to be an Exxon stockholder, has been accused of using his influence as governor to intimidate and control the oil industry to his benefit.
You are listening to a membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our volunteers work hard every day to bring you this coverage of local, national, and international news. So now it's your turn. Joining us now are Conch and Emery to talk about how you can support KBOO Community Radio.
Hey, thank you. Yes, we have just heard some amazing local and international news brought to you by the KBOO News team. And we would especially like to hear, you know, that Kalama story about what's going on in Cowlitz County. within KBOO's listening area up there in Cowles County, just above Clark County. This is really important, and we would love to hear some folks from Southwest Washington. You know, call in right now at 877-500-KBOO. That's a toll-free number, 877-500-5266. We do like to do reporting for all the region, the Gorge, the Willamette Valley, Southwest Washington. Let you all know what's going on that you may not hear on the affiliate station for the networks, some of the other, even the non-corporate stations that really focus on national news. KBOO is a 90%+ local programming outlet and really worth your contribution at kboo.fm or 877-500-KBOO.
You know, so many people are aware that so much of our media is consolidated and owned and influenced by a few companies, business people. And who are those business people? Well, some of them are the people who want to extract, sell, trade fossil fuels. And so when those people are consolidated in power in the news, your news doesn't cover those issues properly. Well, if you call us right now at 877-500-5266 and you throw some money, throw some support behind this radio station and this kind of news programming like the KBOO Evening News, which is volunteer produced 1 hour a day every weekday at 5 o'clock, you can trust that it's going to be on the airwaves and online. Your money goes a long way towards excellent reporting, rare reporting, hard-hitting and very insightful, connected, intelligent reporting that links together international, national issues with incredibly locally important issues. So give us a call, 877-500-5266. Think about, or maybe don't think about, what you can give. What would you give to keep this very rare, hard to find type of programming on the air? Can you give $10 a month? Can you give $10 a week? It's worth it. If you can do it, it's worth it, because when a radio station, when a spot opens up on the airwaves, it gets gobbled up by corporate media, and you get pretty much bad music and bad news. And on KBOO, I guarantee you, here's what you will find: amazing news and amazing music and amazing programming. So give us a call, 877-500-5266. $10 a month, you can get an awesome, KBOO t-shirt designed by artist Anna Vo that looks
very super eerie.
Yeah, it's very eerie. It's very cool. People around town will notice. They will say, "Oh, that is somebody who would listen to KBOO, who would listen to that subversive programming." So go on. If you don't want to give us a call, go online, kboo.fm. But please do it now. Consider it now. The type of programming you're hearing is not to be taken for granted, and it is not supported by huge forces. It is supported by grassroots forces, by people like you, your neighbor, your friends. So give us a call, 877-500-5266.
Or feel free to give us, drop by our place at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. We have volunteers back here who are delighted to help you look through the thank you gift box and also find the right kind of contribution. If you're not sure, we will take the time to help you find out. We have a $350 goal for the show, which is easy to get. What I think we can do is get two people ordering a KBOO versus the Mediazillas t-shirt that says $60 pledge of support, $5 a month. It's a full color t-shirt by cartoonist Matt Worker, who's in Washington, D.C. now, but used to be a Portlander. $5 a month at 877-500-KBOO. Two callers at $5 a month and one caller at $20 a month will put us over the top. And that, for $20 a month, you can get that KBOO hoodie. It's getting to be hoodie season. This is a thick, comfortable, warm hoodie, black with white and blue and red, and it's fantastic. Give us a call now. Contribute. Become a member at 877-500-5266.
University of California, Berkeley has reinstated a course on Palestine that was canceled under pressure from pro-Israel groups. The grassroots group Palestine Legal announced the university reinstated the student-led course titled Palestine, A Settler Colonial Analysis. following an outcry from students and faculty describing the action as a violation of academic freedom. Palestine Legal also sent a letter to the university chancellor, Nicholas Dirks, on behalf of Paul Hadwe, the student giving the course, warning that the suspension infringed on First Amendment rights and principles of academic freedom. Following the outcry, Executive Dean of the College of Letters and Science, Carla Hesse, announced in a statement that the course is reinstated.
You are listening to an hour-long membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can call to renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by calling 877-500-5266. Stay tuned for Cutiepock Talk at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with some clouds and highs around 72 degrees. Today in history, on September 20th, 1962, James Meredith was prevented from enrolling at the University of Mississippi by Governor Ross R. Barnett. Meredith soon became the first black student at Ole Miss. 4 years later, he began the March Against Fear, a walk from Memphis, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi. Meredith was shot but not killed on that walk. Civil rights campaigners from around the nation rallied to his cause. By the time Meredith arrived on foot in Jackson, he led a crowd of 15,000 marchers. The quote of the day is from James Meredith, who said, quote, "When it comes to my rights as an American citizen and yours, I am a triumphalist and an absolutist. Anything else is an insult," end quote.
Attempts to salvage the tattered remains of a Syrian ceasefire agreement have taken center stage at meetings in New York, as world leaders attend the annual United Nations General Assembly meeting. The ceasefire agreement between the U.S. and Russia was for a 7-day truce, which began last Monday, aimed to provide a window during which humanitarian aid could be delivered to civilians trapped in besieged areas of the war-torn country. But on Monday, that very aid became the target of deadly airstrikes. FSRN's Shannon Young has more.
The cautiously optimistic statements of diplomats on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly meeting in New York stand in sharp contrast to an escalating series of attacks on the ground in Syria. Almost immediately after the Syrian military declared the end of a week-long ceasefire, a barrel bomb attack in Orem al-Kubra in rural Aleppo struck a warehouse filled with United Nations Refugee Agency aid. The items, including food, blankets, diapers, and medicine, were to be distributed to almost 80,000 civilians trapped in the besieged area. A video posted online by an organization of Syrian volunteer search and rescue workers known as the White Helmets shows the burning aftermath of the attack. An unidentified White Helmet volunteer says Syrian government forces were behind the bombing.
So the regime and Russia target this place and kill the staff of the Syrian Crescent. As you see, medicine on the ground. Syrian Crescent.
20 civilians and the regional head of the Syrian Arab Red Crescent are among the dead. They were unloading packages from trucks that had just arrived at the warehouse in a marked humanitarian aid convoy when the first bombs dropped. Rescue workers responding to the warehouse bombing were also attacked. Moscow denies either Russian or Syrian government troops were responsible. According to the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, 54 of its staff and volunteers have lost their lives in the line of duty in the last 6 years. Monday's deadly strike on a humanitarian aid convoy and warehouse comes 2 days after U.S.-led airstrikes killed more than 60 Syrian government troops in Deir ez-Zor. U.S. officials say they thought they were striking targets linked to ISIS, also known as Daesh. Acknowledging the U.S.-led strike on Syrian troops, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power said that coalition forces immediately halted the attack when Russia informed them that they may be striking Syrian military personnel. But she called Russia's indignation
uniquely cynical and hypocritical. Since 2011, the Assad regime has been intentionally striking civilian targets with horrifying, predictable regularity. They have besieged civilian areas, prevented life-saving humanitarian aid from reaching people who are starving to death and dying of illnesses that could be treated with basic medicine, which is ripped out of trucks and pocketed by Syrian regime forces.
During a meeting of the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva Monday, Syrian Representative Hossam Eddin Alla roundly condemned the attack.
The planes of the American alliance attacked positions of the Syrian Arab Republic in the surrounding area of the Deir ez-Zor airport, which led to many casualties. This American aggression, which proved to be deliberate and planned, facilitated Daesh's control of this position. And this also proves that this illegal alliance, which was established by the U.S. with the excuse of fighting Daesh, and which contains a number of countries that had a major role to play in arming Daesh, is colluding with this terrorist group and coordinates with them.
Members of the International Syria Support Group met in New York Tuesday, but little came of the gathering other than to reaffirm past stated commitments and an agreement to meet again later this week. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
And now, a community rights commentary from Paul Cienfuegos.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Today I'm going to share some brief excerpts from a new essay titled Learning from the Standing Rock Sioux. It's a community rights analysis of the Native American resistance to the building of an oil pipeline through North Dakota. Here it is. Our Native brothers and sisters have something to teach us, white people of European descent. Don't turn away. What is it that makes a culture devour itself and teach its young to take what it can get today, robbing future generations of health and hope? How does a majority of people settle for toys, entertainment, and convenience, while a minority keeps them in their office cubicles and behind fast food counters as that minority wreaks destruction, raping Mother Earth by drilling holes miles down and wide, poisoning waterways that run like veins and capillaries through this world, making the air venomous with toxins that infuse our bodies and turn the atmosphere into a toilet, and crushing any people who stand in their way. Some Native Americans call the epidemic disease ravaging the colonizer culture Wetiko. The symptoms of Wetiko include the delusion that the dominator society is separate from nature rather than part of it. The Standing Rock Sioux and their indigenous supporters from around the world know the ravages of this mental disease all too well. They have suffered genocide, seen their numbers and their traditions decimated, and witnessed for hundreds of years the trashing of the continent. What is happening at Standing Rock is a profound action by the people who are still human, taking a stand to protect Mother Earth and end the destruction wrought by a diseased culture. Communities in the U.S. began adopting laws securing the inalienable rights of ecosystems to exist and flourish in 2006. Some of our Native brothers and sisters wonder at those of us supporting the codification of Mother Earth's rights in law. Perhaps establishing legal protections for the rights of nature seems odd to them, not because it's false, but because it goes without saying. Why would there need to be a law to protect so obvious a truth? Mother Earth has rights. How could this be otherwise?
It was the rationalization of the barbarity of empire building that converted generations of Christian settlers to believe that God had set them above and apart from nature, which is only a collection of exploitable resources that must be owned as property by a privileged minority. Today, the fact that Mother Earth is a living, breathing entity and that all beings are an integral part of her is denied by the lawyers trying to protect corporate privileges from the witnesses of conscience at Standing Rock. It is denied by the court system, the public and mercenary security personnel, and the clueless media gossiping about the standoff. Judges and lawyers assert without blushing that corporations, pieces of paper chartered into existence with ink and official sigils, have rights. But Mother Earth, river, and trees? Not in this empire. That's why some municipal colonies of the empire write laws codifying rights of nature, because in European-rooted imperial culture, law is a tool of power over people. If it's not written in law, it's not enforceable. But to many Native Americans, the truth of Mother Earth's rights is so deeply known that it need not be codified, but it must still be lived and defended. Without protectors, communities, Native and non-Native alike, will continue to be the sacrifice zones of the oil and gas industry and every other industry that sets its sights on ruining for profit the places where we live. White people are just learning now that we are not above being prey to corporate predators. They are learning what red, black, and brown-skinned people have known for centuries. They are expendable. Most white people in the U.S. grow up believing they are a self-governing people. They believe they live in a democratic republic. They believe their elected officials are public servants obliged to act on the will of the white people. And yet the propaganda that passes for general education is not true. Not only Native Americans and minorities, but white people are denied community self-government. Instead, they elect their jailers as they beat their chests and proclaim they live in the freest nation on earth, while corporations poison us, profit from the destruction of whole species, oceans, and the climate, and our children's future is made precarious. A Pine Ridge Lakota woman once smiled to learn how little power people in U.S. municipalities and counties have to protect the places where they live. She said, quote, "At least we know we live on a reservation," unquote. I've been reading some brief excerpts from an extraordinary new essay published on September 17th titled Learning from the Standing Rock Sioux. Authors Emmeline Liebarger and Ben Price offer a community rights perspective on what is unfolding in North Dakota. The entire essay is viewable at commondreams.org. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CNFuegosPaul. Thanks for listening. And remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
Right now is your chance to show support for the work our volunteers put into bringing this newscast to you, rain or shine, every weekday throughout the year. Joining us now are Emery and Conch to talk about how you can support KBOO Community Radio.
Yes, indeed. We are having our local news right now, and we're going to come back and have KBOO News in depth in just a few minutes. But we want to first thank some of the people who have been calling and checking in on the website. Folks have been calling at toll-free 877-500-KBOO. That's 877-500-5266. Here are some folks who have gone online at kboo.fm to support the news folks here. Carl from Portland. Thank you, Carl. Donald from Gresham. Fantastic. Daniel from Portland. That is great. They've gone to kboo.fm. There's a donate button in the upper right-hand part of the screen. That's on your laptop or desktop or your phone if you get the mobile app from either the iTunes store or the Oh, what do those kids call it? The android. Yes, those androids that have invaded our planet. Get your KBOO mobile app, and it's fantastic. You can actually listen. You can actually go forward and backwards a little ways on the audio. You can listen live. You can listen to things that are archived. KBOO.fm, you can donate. Isn't that right, Emery?
That is totally right. And when you donate, your dollars are going directly towards programs like the KBOO Evening News, which is volunteer produced and hits on and goes deep into topics that you just won't find on corporate consolidated media. We've heard a number of really important issues discussed today on the KBOO Evening News. And by the way, it's put together by volunteers, people from the community who come in, normal and abnormal people from all walks of life, talking about issues that really matter directly to them. These aren't professional journalists trying to be objective. These are people who want to get into the issues because they really feel it's important. So give us a call at 877-500-5266. We're heading back to the news in just a minute, but here are some headlines that were first or only reported on the KBOO News. Koch Brothers Industries show up in a small logging town on Olympic Peninsula. No one but KBOO News noticed. The shutdown of PacifiCorp's Link River Dam. So all sorts of environmental issues. There's a history of good reporting here. ALEC exposes the author of the Monsanto Protection Act in Oregon. Give us a call, 877-500-5266. If you care about the protection of the environment and the voices of oppressed people being on the air, now back to the news.
You're listening to an hour-long membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our great production team for tonight's newscast is Kanan Slett.